Yeah.
From what specific practices that the Canaanites were very much into? Kirby? Yeah. In the form of ritual prostitution, in the form of child sacrifice. That was the rationale that ran behind those. Is that by doing these things, you exercise greater power over the deity than he has over himself. And you get a club over that deity and force him to do something. So the Israelites had imbibed, because they had spent so much time worshiping Baal, that they had imbibed the same attitude toward deity. And they were attempting to do the same thing to the God of Israel. Force him to act. Say, look, either you act or you lose your art. And we know you're not going to do that, so you have to act. We got you. So they thought. Anyway, they brought the ark with them down to Ebenezer, and lo and behold, the Philistines moved up again from their garrison base at Aphek, and they were smitten a second time even worse. And it's interesting, we can just take a moment to notice this in the scriptural account. Something that's interesting about the ways of ancient peoples as reflected in the text is that when they suffered this second defeat, a lot of things happened. They were defeated, a lot of people were killed, including the two priestly sons of Eli, and the ark was captured as well. But notice when the messenger comes back to Israel and gives the message to Eli, the order in which he recites the events. Verse 12. There ran a man of Benjamin out of the army and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. This, again, another time we see this being done as a symbol of mourning, of some great tragedy has befallen, either a significant death or some great tragedy. One does these things. When he came to Eli, remember, Eli had at least enough allegiance to God to have been trembling for the ark all the time it was gone. Now remember, he was the leader of the people, was he not? What should he have done? When the people said, hey, we come to fetch the ark, and we want your two sons to take it with it to the battle, what should he have done? He said, no. But you see, in his old age, not only was he letting his sons do a lot of things that they shouldn't have been doing, which caused God to be angry with him, but also he wasn't exercising his leadership position. All he did was sit back in the camp and tremble because, oh, hope nothing happens to the ark. I mean, this would be horrible. You know, he didn't use the authority he had. And God did not hold him blameless for not using that authority. I think we can see a lesson in many figures in Scripture that when God allows a person to exercise an office of authority and they don't use that authority to prevent evil, God does not hold them blameless. It's like a watchman. He has an office of authority. And if he doesn't use that authority to perform his function, God does not hold him blameless. But notice how the man brings the message, because he hears a lot of noise and shouting and crying in the camp. And he says, I am he that came out of the army. I fled today out of the army. Now that's not a redundancy. He is relating things in a certain rising crescendo. First, I am from the army. That's a neutral statement. No emotional connotations. I fled from the army. That has a suggestion that things are not going well. But there's no indication of how badly they are going. But obviously they're not going well if he has fled. You see? Then he says, there has been a great slaughter among the people. And your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark is taken. This is a typical way a messenger delivered news. You saved the most significant item for last. I mean, you built up to it. Each piece of news was more important than the preceding one. This is just a typical practice. We see it in documents from the period. We see it in a number of other biblical speeches, that there is a rising level of importance. And so I thought I would bring that out as we went past it. Now, the ark was taken, and went on a journey from the area of the conflict, the Battle of Ebenezer, and then it was taken first to Ashdod, then to Gath, then to Ekron. It's sort of a made a circuit of three of the Philistine cities before it was sent back through the Thoric Valley to Beth Shemesh, where it entered Israelite territory and then was taken to Kiriath Yearim, where it stayed for 20 years in Kiriath Yearim. Now, what happened to this ark once it was captured by the Philistines? Now, the Philistines had not expected to win the battle. That is quite evident when we look here in chapter 4. When the Philistines hear the tumult in the camp of Israel and find out through their intelligence, you know, what is the reason for it, notice in verse 7, the Philistines were afraid because they said, God has come into the camp. In verse 8, woe to us! Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues. Now, why are they so afraid of fighting Israel if Israel's God is with them? What concept was common among ancient peoples that caused them to be afraid? Yeah. Susie. Right. And so, therefore, they didn't expect to win. But they did. And what did they do with the ark once they captured it? Where did they put it? Jeff? They took it into the house of Dagon and they set it in front of Dagon. Now, we mustn't misconstrue what they were thinking. This was not a way of taking something of value and giving it as sort of a thank offering to Dagon because he had given them the victory. It relates the same concept of a god being most powerful on his own soil. Dagon was obviously most powerful inside his own temple. So by bringing the God of Israel into the temple of Dagon and putting it in front of the statue of Dagon, their mentality was, our God being stronger on this piece of land will keep the God of Israel under control, locked up in that box, and he won't be able to help his people. That was their mentality. You may remember that when the temple was looted by the Babylonians, they took the furniture and the vessels, and what did they do with them when they took them to Babylon? Where did they put them? In the temple of Marduk. And then when Cyrus let them go back, he took the things out and gave it back to them. Now, the reason they took the temple furniture and vessels and put it into the temple of Marduk is the same reason. There was no image of God, and they didn't have the ark, apparently, either. So they took something representing the God of Israel and put it into their temple so their god Marduk could keep watch over this god. Because we know from other records that whenever they conquered another people, they took the idol of the conquered people, the idols of the conquered people, and they put them in the temple of Marduk so that he could do the same thing that the Philistines were expecting their god to do. This was still the mentality of the people. Well, God worked with the Philistines according to their understandings, because they were exercising some sort of a symbolic message by putting the ark there. God also gave them a symbolic message. What did they find? The statue was fallen over on its side the next morning, and they were perplexed as to how it happened. So they set it up again, and the next time God knocked it down and it broke. And so very quickly they figured out, well, maybe it has something to do with this ark, and they got rid of it. And then God sent plagues on different towns, you see. Now, they began to suspect that maybe there was a connection between having the ark and getting the plagues, but they weren't positive. If they sent the ark away thinking that it was causing the plagues and it had no connection, they would have been giving up their ace in the hole. But if it was causing the plagues, they certainly didn't want to keep it. And so they did something which is typically Greek in culture, because they did come out of a Greek cultural area, the Philistines originally, is they set a test to determine whether the God of Israel really wanted the ark taken out of their territory or not. Remember the test? They took the ark and put it on a cart, and they had it drawn by two oxen that had never known the yoke. Now, never having known the yoke, they would not be used to working together and pulling a cart. They would remember, there was no driver with the cart either. And they chose milch kine, oxen, female oxen that are nursing their young. And as it says, they brought the calves out in front of the oxen. They pointed the cart in the direction of Israelite territory. The oxen are facing that way. They took the calves and put it in front of the mother's eyes, and then they took the calves home. Now, if there was no godly influence involved, what would those oxen have done? Turned around and followed their calves. But no, they went out towards the Israelite territory. Not only did they go out against their bovine nature, but also, though they had never known the yoke and they had no driver, they kept the cart on a straight path, following the road until it got to Israelite territory. Therein the Philistines got their proof. This could not have happened without a God guiding them. You see, but if the oxen had turned around, they would have known that the God of Israel wasn't behind all this, and they would have held on to the ark. So it was a very interesting technique that they used to find out what it was the God of Israel really wanted, so they wouldn't have to give up the ark without a good reason. And that, of course, the end result was that since God was behind the whole situation, that God was the author of the plagues, and a number of scholars have studied the scriptures trying to figure out what specific ailment God inflicted upon them. And I think the leading candidate at the moment is that it was bubonic plague. That's what they were struck with, bubonic plague. So many people have wondered what exactly was this ailment with all these lumps and other associated problems. And of course, rodents are agents of spreading this, and that probably is why they had this tremendous increase in the number of rodents that caused them to create a golden image of these rodents to go also on it. So whether they appreciated the fact that there were bacteria involved or not, I doubt, but they certainly understood the vehicle of transmission. They associated it with the rodents, something that people in the Middle Ages never did. So it's interesting. During this phase also, that it is most probable that Shiloh was destroyed as a follow-up of the Battle of Ebenezer, the second Philistine victory. Archaeologically, there is evidence that Shiloh was destroyed at about this period of time. And there is a... Oh, I didn't bring my Bible. Who wants to loan me one? Not one of those big jobs. I need something I can hold. I don't have big hands. In Jeremiah, actually there's more than one possible reference to this particular destruction of Shiloh, or Shiloh as it should be pronounced. In Jeremiah chapter 7, Jeremiah was addressing a problem of his day. Jeremiah, a true prophet of God, was commissioned to warn the people of Judah that unless they repented and changed their ways, God would punish them by destroying the city of Jerusalem and taking them all into captivity, or almost all into captivity. The people did not believe him. Not because they looked around and said, I don't see any sin. What are you talking about, sin? It doesn't exist here, you know. It wasn't that reason they didn't believe in. They didn't believe that no matter how bad they were acting, God could punish them that severely. Because if God were to punish them that severely and destroy Jerusalem, that would mean that his own temple would be destroyed, and God would never allow that. That was their conviction. And that's why Jeremiah was commissioned by God, as we read in chapter 7 of Jeremiah, to stand in the gate of the Eternal's house and proclaim there this word. and say, "Hear the word of the Eternal, all you of Judah that enter in at these gates to worship the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. But don't trust in lying words." What were those lying words? Deceiving words. The temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal are these. In other words, don't say, look, God can't really, he could have punished the northern kingdom and drive them into captivity because they didn't have a true temple. But God can't do that to us because we have the temple. The temple guarantees our safety, that God cannot really destroy Jerusalem. That's what they were thinking. That's what they were saying. Now, how they got that feeling that God, even when he was angry and would punish, would always stop short of Jerusalem, would not touch the apple of his eye, so to speak, and therefore they could just poo-poo what Jeremiah was saying, to use an expression, is because, you know, we'll take up later in the semester how they got that particular conviction. But they had that conviction. Now, one of the things that Jeremiah was instructed to say as a way of telling them that just because Jerusalem had God's sanctuary did not mean that Jerusalem would always be inviolate, as we read down here in verse 8, it says, "You trust in lying or deceiving words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you know not, and then come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name, and say, 'We are delivered to do all these abominations?'" He says here in verse 12, "Rather, go now to my place that was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel." Now that seems to be a reference to a destruction of Shiloh that God allowed because of the sin of the people. And that would fit very well in the time period we're talking about, where the people had committed this very grave sin of using the ark as a way to bind God to do their will, where Eli was not exercising the authority God had given them to prevent this, and he was not exercising his authority to correct his own sons who were doing evil as official representatives of God. And so God's name was being blasphemed as a result. So this is one of those places where we seem to have a reference to the destruction of Shiloh in this period. And if my memory serves me, I believe it is also, there is also a reference in verse 55, Psalm 78, verse 55. "He cast out the heathen before them, divided them an inheritance by line, and made the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents." That's interesting, showing the kind of lifestyle Israel had soon after entering the land, which would help to explain why they didn't need to occupy city sites immediately upon conquering them, and why we don't find many remains of their settlements until much later. They were not yet citified, urbanized. "Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God and kept not his testimonies, but turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow. They provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. And when God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he had placed among them, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand." So this might also be a reference for this. It says, "He gave his people over also unto the sword. The fire consumed their young men. Their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by their sword." So it is quite possible, as I say, that this is a reference to that particular time, that particular event. So archaeology seems to indicate, as I said, also a destruction at Shiloh at this particular point in time. Now, this involved, following this horrible tragedy, an extended phase of occupation of the central hill country. The Philistines were very anxious that they should keep them under firm control. Now, there were certain features of this occupation, certain characteristics that we might make note of. First of all, the Philistines seem to have maintained a monopoly on the use of iron. For the obvious reasons, they didn't want the Israelites to be using iron for making things other than farm implements. And we have a scripture in 1 Samuel chapter 13, which refers to this situation. Oops, I just flew off one of your little tab endings. Came flying off as I flipped the page. Better turn it up so I can see it. 1 Samuel 13, verse 19. There was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share and his coulter and his axe and his mattock. Now, this is a very poor translation still. Is this a New King James? No, it's the Old King James. That explains why it's the poor translation. Who has a more modern translation for verse 21? Ken?
The charge for a sharpener was a...
Yeah, that's what it should be. And we've been able to reconstruct the relative worth of that figure. And it'd be equivalent as, if you wanted to go in and, I'm trying to think of an equivalent here now for a second. Say with your automobile and you wanted to just have a tire changed and they charged you $100 to do it. I mean, not, I'm exaggerating to a degree, but it was an exorbitant charge for this sharpening. So they were adding insult to injury. Not only weren't they allowed to do this themselves or able to do it themselves, they had to go to the Philistines to get these things done, but they charged them exorbitantly as well. This is something that's been established as we've been able to find out more information about what this unit of money was worth relative to the job that would be involved. So it says in verse 22, so it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan. Only with Saul and with Jonathan was there a sword found. You see, there was very great difficulty they had in eventually securing their independence. Weapons were kept out of their hands. Another aspect of this particular oppression of the Philistines was they maintained garrisons in the hill country. And we have a reference to some of these garrisons that are mentioned. They're not the main focus of the text. It's just sort of mentioned parenthetically. For example, when Saul, after he had been anointed by Samuel, and he was told by Samuel, because Samuel was given by God the gift of prophesying this, what was going to happen to him in the next day or two. One of the things that Samuel prophesied to him, as we find in 1 Samuel chapter 10, in verse 5, is after that you shall come to the hill of God, where there is a garrison of the Philistines. And it tells him what he's going to experience as he gets there. It's sort of a parenthetical statement, but shows us something of the political situation just at the time that Saul was chosen to become king. We also have another reference in 1 Samuel to a garrison, in this case chapter 13, 1 Samuel 13, where it talks about Jonathan's activities. 1 Samuel 13, verse 3, it speaks about Jonathan smiting the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. So we have another mention there. And then we have a reference in connection with David in 2 Samuel chapter 23. This is not in a time sequence situation. This is sort of a recapitulation of David's reign. The entire chapter is sort of a recapitulation of his reign, and it sort of is a flashback to an incident in his earlier life. And we find in 2 Samuel chapter 23 that verse 14, that David was then in the hold, or the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. So that was another location where there was a Philistine garrison. So we have, you know, a few scattered references that indicate that this was part of the overall Philistine approach to maintaining a close watch upon Israel, was to maintain garrisons. Now, how can the presence of these garrisons in the time when Saul was chosen to be king over Israel by Samuel, and even after he began to reign, and the presence of a garrison even later, which David encountered, how do these things jive, so to speak, with the statement we find in 1 Samuel 12, which is sort of a important chapter. It's the only one that shows Samuel involved in a military activity, in a position of leadership in that way. And we'll come back to this in a few minutes when we talk more about Samuel and the various offices that he held. That in 1 Samuel chapter 12, after he delivers sort of an address to Israel, reminding them about God's continuous love and mercy, contrasting it with their infidelity, and yet the fact that God has continued to send judges to deliver them out of the hands of their oppressors, that they have always continued to be unfaithful, and that if they continue in this pattern, that God's going to abandon both them and the king which they have called for. But if they remain faithful to God, he goes on and says, you know, that God, of course, will remain constant with them. Now, they do experience a great victory here. And my eye is not finding this particular phrase that I want. Give me just a minute here. Maybe I have the wrong chapter. I think I want something in 1 Samuel chapter 7. Yeah, that's it. 1 Samuel chapter 7. I got these two incidents confused in my mind. This is where Samuel is the deliverer from the people at Mitzpah, in a military sense. And we find that in verse 13, 1 Samuel 7, verse 13, that the Philistines were subdued, and they came no more into the coast of Israel. The hand of the Eternal was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron even unto Gath. The coasts of Israel were delivered out of the hands of the Philistines. And there was even peace between Israel and the Amorites, the Canaanitish people that lived in the hill country, as a result of Samuel's deliverance. Now, how do we square that with the situation that we read later on in the book of Samuel, at the time of Saul and later on of David, that there were Philistine garrisons? Well, I think that what we have to understand is the way this is meant. Or I think this phrase, all the days of Samuel, it doesn't mean all the days that he lived. It meant all the days of his active judgeship, you see. They were free of this Philistine encroachment. Well, what is it that happened to Samuel as he reached advanced age? What did he do to sort of relieve the burden of his office, Mr. Knocker? Right. You see, so when his active judgeship ended and he turned over most of his responsibilities to his sons, who did not prove to be worthy of that office, that's when God began to allow the Philistines to renew their pressure. And of course, that's what allowed them to put their garrisons again in the hill country, subjecting Israel to pressure in their own heartland, you might say. And it is that renewed pressure which caused Israel to ask for a king. You see, all the time from the time of Samuel's victory at Mizpah until he turned things over to his sons, they had peace from the Philistines. But then after he turned things over to his sons and they went astray, and God punished Israel by allowing the Philistines to get the upper hand again, the people then said, look, Samuel can't continue to lead us. He's too old. His sons are no good. We have to have somebody else. Now, we'll come back to this particular incident in a few minutes. But before we get to Saul, let's take a look at Samuel, a closer look at Samuel, and see a rather unique individual in terms of the servants of God. Because he was a judge, he was also the priest, and he was also a prophet. There is no other instance where you meet a leader of God after the, all the time from the Exodus until the carrying away into captivity in Babylon, where you have one servant occupying all three of these offices. Even Moses only occupied two. Moses functioned as a judge, in a sense, the way the later judges did, and he also functioned as a prophet. We don't usually think of Moses as a prophet, but he was. And indeed, one of the scriptures in Deuteronomy says that when God raises up a prophet like unto Moses, you shall listen to him. Indicating that he was used of God in that role. But Samuel held all three of these offices. Now, the traditional job of a judge was twofold. He acted as a deliverer, or she acted as a deliverer of the people from an oppressor, and also helped to resolve complicated legal situations. Remember, we took a look earlier on that God instructed the people while they were in the wilderness, that we find this in Deuteronomy 17, that if the local city elders found a case too difficult to figure out what to do, they were to go to the place where God had put his name and consult with the Levitical priests and with the judge who would be in that day to find out what they should do, what the sentence of judgment should be. So the job of a judge was both military deliverer and it was as a judge in the sense that we understand the term. Now, we see Samuel acting as a judge in the case of a military deliverer in 1 Samuel chapter 7. We won't take the time to read the chapter. You can look at it on your own. I just referred to it. At Mizpah, he gathered the people together, and the people attacked the Philistines with great success. We also see him serving as a judge in the more traditional sense, where he had a circuit, where he actually went about his business in judging the people.
We're continuing with our lectures on the conflict between Israel and the Philistines. In this context, we've already considered the initial phase, one oppression of the Philistines against the tribes of Dan and Judah that was relieved by Samson's sacrifice of his own life in the temple. And then the renewal of the oppression at the time of Eli, at the time of the Battle of Ebenezer, when the ark was captured, and how eventually Samuel, when he became a man and already had an established reputation as both a priest and a judge and a prophet, that he was used as the instrument for the relief of Israel from the worst of this oppression, although there was still a Philistine presence in Israelite territory. There were garrisons of the Philistines at a number of points, although it was a much milder form of oppression. Now we come down to the beginning of phase three, which also coincides with the decision of the Israelite tribal leaders that they wanted to set up a monarchy similar to the monarchy that existed in the surrounding nations. Now, we have to understand that just by asking for a king, this was not of and by itself a rejection of God. I think we've all read that passage in the first book of Samuel, chapter 8, where Samuel, of course, was very displeased that the people asked him to make them a king. And then God intervened and said, you know, look, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. Now, we have to understand why it is that it was a rejection of God, and yet the people were not really so conscious of that. It wasn't a conscious rejection of God, because if it had been a conscious rejection of God, they would never have gone to Samuel to make themselves the king. They had just chosen somebody by themselves, if it was a total desire to reject God's influence. But obviously they sought out Samuel because he was acknowledged to be a servant of God, and they were hoping that this would work out well for themselves. What we have to understand is the essential difference between a judge and a king. Because when you look at it and study their functions, there does not appear to be any difference in function. And there isn't any. What did the judge do? I mean, the one that figures largely in the text, somebody like a Gideon or a Ehud or a Jephthah. They were their military protectors of the people. They were the ones that led them out in times of war against their oppressors. And they judged the people. They administered justice to the people. Now, when the people asked Samuel for a king, notice how they phrase this in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, verse 20. We may also be like all the nations that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. The function of the king is supposed to be the same as that already exercised by a judge. So why then are the people asking for a king? If there's no difference in function, why did it occur to the people that a judge won't do? We have to have a king if they both perform the same functions. And this is where there is a rejection of God. If we understand the difference, despite the seeming lack of difference, we will understand why it was a rejection of God. And the answer is that a king, once he has been chosen, you establish a dynasty. From among his sons comes the next ruler. But judgeship, by its very nature, was not dynastic. A judge died, and you had no idea where the next judge would come from or when. Because it would be God who would signify who should be the next judge and when that judge should begin his functioning.